All right. Brothers, it's good to be here. I very much appreciate Kevin's invitation to talk to you today about Paul the Preacher. I was actually supposed to speak here last year. I did a paper, but about four or five days before the conference, one of my wife's relatives died, and she felt compelled to go to the funeral, so I wasn't able to come here. And I should publicly thank Kevin for presenting my paper. Whatever damage I did, I think he undid. But I appreciate him taking that at the last moment. I know that was a big thing for him. But it's always a joy to be here. Kevin was remarking about his impression of the church in Thessalonica. Not long after I started preaching full time, I did a study of Thessalonians. Thessalonians was one of probably three of the earliest books I ever just thoroughly studied after I started preaching. And it's interesting that was one of his two observations are very similar to what I came away with when I studied 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. And particularly for me, just my observations about Paul and what you could tell about his work based on these two letters. And that's what I want to talk about a little bit today. I came across a quotation a while back I thought was interesting when I was trying to develop my approach for this lesson. This is a quotation from Lytton Strachey. He was a sort of a post-Victorian era biographer. Some have credited him with sort of being the father of the modern historical biography. And he wrote a very famous book, Eminent Victorians, in 1918. And he described how you take a vast amount of literature and decide what you're going to talk about. And I love this quotation. He said, "This historian will row out over that great ocean of material and lower down into it here and there a little bucket, which will bring up to the light of day some characteristic specimen from those far depths to be examined with careful curiosity." When you come to the work of Paul, you have oceans and buckets. First of all, there is just this vast amount of information that we have about Paul in the New Testament. You think about the book of Acts. Over half of the book of Acts is dedicated to Paul from Luke's biographical perspective. Likewise, about half of the New Testament comes from Paul's own writings, so he provides us with an autobiographical perspective. And this isn't even counting all the commentaries and background stuff, just secondary sources that we have. So there is just this vast ocean of material to sift through when you think about Paul as a preacher. So what I'm going to try to do is take some of that background information and start with it, but then at some point we need to take a bucket called 1st and 2nd Thessalonians and drop it in there and see what comes up. Because when you look at Acts 17 and 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, I think you learn some specific things about Paul as a preacher that help you appreciate the larger body of his work. So that's kind of the approach I'm attempting to take. On page 27, you've got the preview. This is what I'll be talking about. I'm going to be covering this paper pretty much straight through in order, and my charts pretty much match what I've got. I've changed a few headings just for the sake of space on the PowerPoint, but we'll talk about the background of Paul's life, some of his methodology, the content of his teaching, some of the approaches that he took when he was teaching and preaching in various situations, Paul's character, and then the legacy that Paul has. This first bit of information about Paul's background, I don't think I'm breaking any new ground here. There are two distinctive features about him, both of which play into his work. First of all, the fact that he was a devout Jew, and secondly, he was privileged as a Roman citizen. I see a lot of parallels between his qualifications as an apostle and Moses' qualifications as the lawgiver. Moses had the best of two worlds. He was a Jew by birth, but he was also raised as an Egyptian, and those two things together greatly impacted his capacity to lead the people. And I think you've got the same kind of factors at play in Paul's life. He was both a Jew and a Roman citizen. His Jewish heritage, there are bits and pieces of information scattered throughout the New Testament, particularly in his writings and also in the book of Acts, that tell us a few things about his life as a Jew. First of all, he was a full-blooded Hebrew. He calls himself a Hebrew of Hebrews. He was full-blooded Jewish. There were some Jews in the New Testament who were, pardon the expression, but they were half-breeds. They would have a Gentile parent and a Hebrew parent. Both of Paul's parents were Hebrews, and apparently he could trace his lineage back all the way. He was a Benjamite, he tells us. The very fact that he was named Saul, that was his Jewish name. He may very well have been named after King Saul, who was the most eminent member of the Benjamite tribe. Circumcised the eighth day as the law commanded. From his Jewish upbringing, he would have been raised in a home where Aramaic was spoken as the native tongue. I do believe he probably knew Greek as well, maybe even a little bit of Latin. But anyway, he grew up speaking Aramaic. If obviously he probably read the Hebrew scriptures, so he probably knew Hebrew as well. But anyway, all of this tells me that he was a man who was thoroughly immersed in Jewish culture and Jewish thinking. He was a full-fledged Pharisee. At one point, he says he was educated in the city of Jerusalem at the feet of Gamaliel. From what we know about Jewish custom, typically, if you went to be trained by a rabbi, it would start at approximately the age of 13. So at some point as a young teenager, he was brought to the city of Jerusalem, studied under Gamaliel, who was probably the foremost Pharisee of Paul's day. So he was thoroughly imbibed in the Pharisee way of looking at things. As a Pharisee, he would have strictly observed Sabbath laws. He would have strictly observed food laws, strictly observed tithing. He had a very conservative approach to the law of Moses. He would have believed in the bodily resurrection, would have believed in angels and spirits, say in contrast to the Sadducees. So here is a man who was very devout in his approach to Judaism. He also had a very high regard for the law of Moses. I have on page 28 a few statements just taken straight out of his some of his defenses from the book of Acts. Acts 22, verse 3 and 4, he was brought up strictly according to the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, just as you all are today. I persecuted this way to the death, binding and putting both men and women into prison. In Acts 23, verse 1, he said, I have lived my life with a perfectly good conscience up to this day. He believed everything that was in accordance with the law and the prophets. Point E there, he used to persecute the church of God beyond measure, tried to destroy it. Philippians 3, verse 6, as to zeal, a persecutor of the church, as to the righteousness which is in the law, found blameless. That last statement, every time I encounter that in Philippians, that is just a remarkable thing to say. That was not a boast. That was not arrogance on Paul's part. That was simply an assertion that he did to the very best of his ability what the law of Moses required. So you will not find anyone who was more thoroughly devoted to the law of Moses and the ways of Judaism. And finally, we have these tantalizing clues here and there in the book of Acts and a few other places. The man was very well connected. I wish I knew more about his personal life. I wish I knew more about his family life. Apparently, he had some connections to the Jewish council. The very fact that he is the coat hanger for that group in Acts chapter 7, how did he get in that position? And again, he's a relatively young man at that point. How is it that he is able to have the authority that he did to travel to distant cities under the authority of the Jewish council and take prisoners and do the things that he did? Obviously, the man had some pretty good connections. Then there is his Roman heritage. He was a Roman citizen. He was also a citizen, by the way, of Tarsus. But for him to be, he says in the book of Acts, he was born as a Roman citizen, which meant that his parents had to be Roman citizens. The fact that he was a citizen of Tarsus means that probably his parents were citizens in Tarsus as well, which meant that that family had a long standing there. The fact that he is a Roman citizen gave him all kinds of privileges as a Roman citizen. Let's see, page 29, if I can find my place. There's a quotation in the middle of that page. Roman citizenship involved the privileges of a vote in the Roman popular assemblies, the full protection of Roman law, and exemption from paying most taxes. During his travels, most likely he carried something sort of the equivalent of a birth certificate, some sort of document. He probably had it in a protected case of some sort that gave authenticity to his Roman citizenship if there was ever any question about it. Also, it's possible, I don't know that I could prove this, but it's possible that he may have had a halfway decent education in Tarsus. Tarsus of Cilicia was a very prominent city. It was ranked by ancient historians as one of the three top educational centers in the Roman Empire, alongside of Athens and Alexandria, and some even put it above them as far as the zeal of those people who were students there. That's a remarkable statement. Paul exhibits a pretty good knowledge of some Greek poetry. He periodically quotes Greek poets in his writings. He seems to exhibit, I think, some knowledge of Greek rhetorical skill. If that's the case, it begs the question, where did he get it? And it may be that as a citizen of the city of Tarsus, maybe he learned a few things in the educational system there. As far as Paul's method, and I talk here about some of his methodology as an apostle, there were a number of factors that allowed him to travel freely and take advantage of just prevailing cultural circumstances in his work as an apostle. For example, the Roman peace, the Pax Romana, peace around the Mediterranean, Roman Empire around the Mediterranean Rim. There was military presence throughout the empire. There were established roadways throughout the empire that any Roman citizen was free to travel. No passport was needed. Periodically, he did have to invoke his Roman citizenship. There were various taxes that were not imposed upon Roman citizens. There were established legal rights that he had, and you see him exercising that periodically in the book of Acts. Greek language and culture, mainly because of Alexander the Great, who spread Roman culture all throughout that part of the world, it benefited Paul greatly. There was a common language. The Koine Greek in New Testament times was spoken just about everywhere. And Paul could go to these cities and he could talk to them in a language that just about everybody understood. Also, just some of the cultural conventions that you see among Greeks and Romans were common throughout the empire. Also, the Jewish religion. Paul very much took advantage of that as he traveled from place to place, as we've already seen. His typical approach when he went to a new city was start where? Started in the Jewish synagogue, because he would find a ready audience. As a Jew, he could connect with them, but that also, you think about this, it also gave him contact with God-fearers. It also gave him contact with proselytes. And so that gave him a base of operations not only among the Jews, but also among Gentiles as well. And from that, from the Jewish synagogue, it allowed him to spread out into the surrounding community. As far as his choice of cities, this is just some general observations. There have been a lot of studies done by this, by various scholars. There seemed to be some things that Paul preferred when he would go from place to place. Now, he didn't always have control over it. Even as I say these things, I kind of see the irony with his second journey. His second journey was almost a disaster every place he went. Almost nothing went the way he planned it to go. He apparently wanted to basically go to Ephesus and spend some time there, but the Lord didn't let him. At the very start, he didn't get the partner that he wanted. He wanted Barnabas to go back with him, but they had a falling out over that. So many things in his second journey did not go the way he planned. Nonetheless, I still think we see some strategies on Paul's part no matter where he went. He preferred urban centers. Most of the cities that he went to were fairly large. Even by modern standards, some of these cities that he went to from place to place were very large places. He seemed to prefer governmental centers, provincial capitals, administrative centers, Roman colonies. Again, not exclusively, but that seems to be a consistent pattern. Most of these cities were seaports or major centers of commerce and industry and trade. He seemed to prefer religious centers. Most every place he went did have a Jewish synagogue. And in addition to that, many of the places he went had major temples, major centers of pagan worship. That was a pretty consistent thing in the places that he chose. And in addition to that, I would just add this other thing. They were cultural centers. They were places where there were schools or universities. They had libraries. They had amphitheaters. They had gymnasia. They had baths. They had festivals. These were places where people would come to get something. They would come to these towns because they needed to get a court case settled. They would come here to do business. They would come here to get an education. And in coming to these places, they would take these cultural things and disseminate them when they went back to their homes. And I think Paul took advantage of that in the preaching of the gospel. When they came to these places, one of the things that his converts found was the gospel itself. And then when they went back to their homes, I think they took it with them. But that may be part of the reason why he evangelized the places that he did. As he went from place to place, the starting point was typically the synagogues, but we also see other venues as well. We see the places of prayer. Philippi is a great example of that. The marketplace or the agora. Several times in Paul's preaching, he partly when he was working on his own, as in Corinth, The marketplace served as a good place to talk to people. People today use their workplaces as a starting point for discussions of the gospel. Paul was no different. Local council meeting places. The Areopagus was sort of a local cultural slash religious council, and when he was called to appear before them, they were sort of exercising some local authority that they had, and it may be that he used that in other situations as well. Obviously, he met with Christians in houses from time to time, and in at least one occasion, he met in a school, a school of philosophy, basically is what it was, and he used their facilities as a starting point in his teaching. Let's see. I want to talk a little bit about his teaching method. If you turn over to Acts 17, this is one of the first things that, as I mentioned many years ago, when the first time I did a in-depth study of Thessalonians, this was something that I saw that very much fascinated me. Acts 17, according to Paul's custom, verse 2, he went with them, and for three Sabbaths, there's three key words here. He reasoned with them from the Scriptures. Number two, explaining. And then number three, giving evidence that the Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead, saying, "This Jesus whom I am proclaiming to you is the Christ." And verse 4 says the result, some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas. Three key words here. The first word, reasoned, is dialegomai. The word dialegomai means to converse or discourse with one, to argue or discuss something, to speak in a somewhat formal setting, probably implying a more formal use of language, to address or make a speech, to reason, to argue, to prove, to persuade. Mount says that in Acts, dialegomai is carried out primarily through preaching and teaching, often based in Scripture. Such reasoning apparently could go on for quite a time with Paul. It's interesting, and this is at the bottom of page 31, 10 of the 13 uses of this word occur in the book of Acts, and in every occurrence in the book of Acts, it is always in reference to Paul's activity. And I think that gives you an idea of part of Paul's teaching method. We get our word dialogue from this. He dialogued with people as he taught them. The second word is the word explaining. Dianoigo is the word that's used here. It means to open up completely, to open up the sense of Scriptures, to explain them, to open the mind of one, causing him to understand the thing. This is on page 32, some of the definitions I'm reading. Of eight New Testament uses, five of them are metaphorical, that is, in the sense of recognition or understanding. Luke 24, verse 31, it talks about recognizing a person. Luke 24, 32, Acts 17, verse 3, it speaks of understanding the Scriptures. In Luke 24, verse 45, it talks about a person's mind. And in Acts 16, verse 14, it talks about the opening of a person's heart. Paul opened the Scriptures in the course of his synagogue discussion. He made them plain by drawing from them and clarifying them. And then finally, the word giving evidence, paratithemi. It means to place beside or before, often used in its literal sense of material things as well as in its more common significance, to commit and trust. Twice it means to set before one in teaching, as in putting forth a parable. Thayer says it is to place beside, to place near, to place before, to set before one in teaching, to set forth from oneself to explain. F.F. Bruce says, and this is about two-thirds of the way down on page 32, he brought forward as evidence of their fulfillment the historical facts recently accomplished in the ministry, death, and resurrection of Jesus, setting these events alongside the predictions in order that the force of his argument might be readily grasped. On the one hand, he has the scriptural statements from the Old Testament. On the other hand, he's got the factual statements from the life of Jesus. He lays one alongside the other to help demonstrate their proof. This is basically the language of rhetoric and persuasion and teaching, and this is how Paul typically did this. I think what Paul did here in Acts 17 is typical of what he did wherever he went. The results of it, the immediate results, and David talked about this a little bit earlier in verses 4 through 9, there were some Jews who were persuaded, a large number of God-fearing Greeks, and a number of the leading witnesses. Number of the leading women. And then in the long term, what we can say is he left behind a congregation that was established there. There's a quotation on page 33, and I want to read this. Now, this is Roland Allen, and he's talking about sort of the sum total of Paul's teaching. As you look backward at all of the places where he evangelized, and I would say what he says of all of Paul's churches, you could say of Thessalonica as well. The churches were really established. Whatever disasters fell upon them in later years, whatever failure there was, whatever ruin, that failure was not due to any insufficiency or lack of care and completeness in the apostles' teaching or organization. When he left them because his work was fully accomplished. And whenever I think about Thessalonica in particular, we've had some discussion about the length of Paul's stay, at least 3 weeks. And just if you look at the total chronology of his second tour, not more than about 6 months. But in that short amount of time, Paul went to a place where the gospel had never been heard. He preached it to them, and in a relatively short time, he left there, and there was a congregation that survived. And not only did they survive, they thrived as well. And not only that, but they survived and thrived under intense persecution. That is a remarkable thing to me, that Paul could do this and in so short a time have this kind of result. Again, there's already been some discussion about that, but it tells me a lot about Paul and how he was able to proclaim the gospel in a way that people really understood what he was talking about. They understood the nature of the commitment, and he persuaded them to follow through on that. Another interesting thing to me about Paul, and particularly when we drop the bucket in this ocean of Paul's material, what did Paul teach when he was in Thessalonica? And I think 1 and 2 Thessalonians are particularly good about giving us information regarding his teaching. We got basically two sources of information, Paul's letters and also some statements from Acts chapter 17. If you look at some statements from 1 and 2 Thessalonians, he makes a number of backward-looking statements. He says, "You yourselves know, you recall, you know this, we told you, we kept telling you, as you received from us, you have no need for someone to teach you these things," he says. "You were taught. While we were there, we used to do these things." 1 and 2 Thessalonians are loaded with these kinds of references, which tells me that Paul is looking backwards and trying to get them to look backwards at some of the things that he talked about while he was there. Now, if you start looking at the statements that accompany these phrases, you get a fairly complete picture of some of the things that Paul taught while he was there. You go back to Acts 17. In verse 3, that Christ had to suffer and die and be raised from the dead. They knew something about Christ's death, burial, and resurrection. He uses the phrase in Acts 17, verse 3, "this Jesus." And if you've ever studied much about some of the sermons and the teachings in the book of Acts, for the first century Jews, Jesus was Christ was a huge issue. Now, for us, when we say Jesus Christ, it's almost like his first and last name. We just put the two together automatically. For the first century Christians and the first century Jews and the first century apostles, as they tried to teach, that was the issue. Was Jesus of Nazareth also the Christ of God? And just the very fact that he uses "this Jesus was the Christ who had to suffer, die, and be raised," that suggests to me that he explained something to them about the life of Jesus. They knew something about Jesus who was from Nazareth. He also says that Jesus was the Christ. He also says in Acts 17, verse 7, that Jesus was the King. If you look at those "you know" or "you remember" or "you recall" statements in 1 Thessalonians, he talks about the true God versus idols. He talks about Jesus' return. He talks about the judgment. He talks about them walking worthily. He talks about their suffering. He talks about their walk in the kingdom. He talks about their sanctification. He talks about the Lord as an avenger of wrongs. He talks about the need for brotherly love. He talks about their working quietly. He talks about the second coming. He talks about their attitude of anticipation toward the second coming. Apparently, these were things that, as you read through 1 Thessalonians, these were things they had already discussed, which tells me, again, this is something that he probably taught while he was in the city of Thessalonica. If you continue the line of reasoning into 2 Thessalonians, for all of the trouble that we have, when we talk about the man of sin, talk about the apostasy in 2 Thessalonians, there's that curious statement. You remember while I was there, we talked about this? I'd kind of like to know more about that. Unfortunately, we don't. But apparently, they had some discussions about this before he ever left. And related to that is information about the second coming, He makes some statements about their knowing that they would be persecuted, their knowing about steadfastness and persecution. And also there are references, to the issue to the person who was not working as he should have worked. There are references to the fact that, look, we've talked about this already. So there were apparently discussions about that as well. When I put all of this together, I am just amazed at how much he taught them in so short of a time. But I don't think this is exceptional. I mean, obviously, the length of Paul's stay in Thessalonica, I think, is exceptional. I think most places he probably stayed a little bit longer. But still, I'm just amazed at how much he taught them in so short a time. However, there are statements elsewhere. For example, in Acts chapter 20, there is the reference that he was there for approximately 3 years. I'm just going to refer to it. I'm not going to read the verses. I will probably read the verses at a later section. But remember in Acts chapter 20, when he was talking to the Ephesian elders, he said that in the time he was there, he taught them the whole counsel of God. And in a later verse, he says that he was there for about 3 years. In 3 years' time, and again, Thessalonica is a good illustration of this. In 3 years' time, Paul taught them basically everything they needed to know. And I have to confess here, when I look at my own preaching and teaching sometimes, I wonder, good grief, what have I done in the last 3 years? What have I done in the last year? Sometimes it is so easy to kind of get sidetracked in our preaching and teaching that we kind of forget the big picture. Am I really covering the things that need to be addressed? Am I covering the things that this congregation needs to hear? I know all of us wrestle with, well, here's what I think they need, here's what they're asking me for, here's what I'm interested in, and we try to find a happy intersection between all of those wants and needs and desires. That's not always easy to do, but I am amazed when I look at Paul. That's, by the way, my summary of everything on the previous three charts, but anyway. But his thoroughness in so short a time, his sense of purpose and discipline. Obviously, when he went into a congregation or when he went into a community, he seemed to have some very specific things in mind about what he was trying to accomplish. And I think that is reflected in the rigor and discipline of his teaching. And I think you also see here with Paul a reflection of what he thought were the essentials that these people needed to know. And again, that can be such a hard thing. What is it that this person or this group of people really need to hear? Sometimes that can be a very difficult thing. Obviously, it depends on the maturity level of various people, but Paul seemed to have a very good grasp on that. And also, this first point that I had up here about Paul's commentary, when you look at these statements by Paul in 1 and 2 Thessalonians, it kind of gives you an idea, okay, what did they know as we come into these letters? How do I understand these letters in light of what they already knew? It kind of gives you a different sort of perspective. The next thing in my paper on pages 35 through 39, I talk about Paul's approach. For me, this is a relatively new line of inquiry. I debated if I was even going to put it in or not. I thought about putting it as an appendix, but I decided to include it. It goes back to what we saw in Acts 17, the language. He reasoned with them. He explained. He gave evidence. Several years ago, I stumbled across a commentary that talked about the use of rhetoric in the New Testament, in Paul's letters, in Paul's speeches. And for me, that just opened up all kinds of new vistas. It was some things I had not really considered before. And at least for me, anyway, it proved a very helpful way of trying to understand what is going on in some of the speeches and sermons and letters in the New Testament. And so because it has been helpful for me, I thought I would approach this from the standpoint of how Paul did some of this as well. I want to talk a little bit about rhetoric. Rhetoric is the art of persuasion. How did a speaker or a writer influence his audience through his speeches, through his writings, to come to some sort of a decision? Basically, that's what rhetoric was. Again, I want to go back to the book of Acts. At the top of page 35, I think Luke very much tries to portray the Apostle Paul as someone who was a very persuasive teacher. I think Luke had an apologetic purpose when he wrote the book of Acts. He's trying to show that the Christians were not just a bunch of nuts. They weren't these itinerant philosophers going from place to place causing trouble. Paul could go into a place, take the very best educated people, the most religious people in that community, the most respectable people in a community and persuade them by the sheer force of his arguments that they needed to make a change. And I think that's reflected in Paul's use of language. In the book of Acts, 10 times, as we've already seen, the word reason is used in reference to Paul's teaching. He reasoned with these people. He persuaded them. 5 times, this word is used in reference to what Paul was doing. Paul persuaded them. Paul was persuading them. And 3 times, it refers to the effect of Paul's teachings. They were persuaded by what Paul did. In other words, Luke is pointing to Paul as someone who knew basically the rules of rhetoric. He knew how to persuade people by the truth that he presented. I'm sure all of us have had experiences where we hear from time to time maybe 2 different preachers preach pretty much on the same subject, and you walk away from one saying, wow, because one of them is very persuasive. The other one, I mean, I know in some of my early preaching and probably more recent preaching, there were times I would just kind of present things and I would say, okay, here's the facts, now go take that. And good grief, I don't know how many people I put to sleep that way. The gospel is more than just a presentation of facts. It is presentation of facts with a purpose. It is to exhort people to make a decision. And simply presenting factual information is not a sermon. It's boring. And it puts people to sleep, and you run the risk of making people think that's what the gospel is about. Paul, when he presented the gospel, made people think. He made them want to do something about their spiritual lives. And I believe he did it through the use of rhetoric. Greco-Roman rhetoric is basically the art of persuasion. They made 3 kinds of appeals, generally, in any kind of speech or letter or whatever else. 3 types of appeals. There was athos, which is basically building the character and trustworthiness of the speaker. Let me tell you something. How many of you trust TV salesmen? How many of you trust the salesmen you see on TV? I don't see any. Why? Because they have not established any credibility. Now, you sit down with a person and you talk to them for a while. They may persuade you that their product is worth buying. Have you ever been persuaded by a salesman in a face-to-face setting? I have, several times. Because I saw something in them that I believed was trustworthy. The first thing that a speaker tried to do was establish his credibility. The second thing is logos, which is facts, arguments. This is usually the bulk of a sermon, the bulk of a speech, the bulk of a letter. You're trying to prove your particular proposition. And then there is pathos, which has to do with the emotions of the speaker. In sales talk, this is the wrap-up. This is where you try to get the person really involved in what you're doing. It's that last few set of appeals that the salesman makes before he closes the sale. He's trying to make sure that not only you believe what he's saying, but you have gotten that person emotionally involved in what you're trying to do. Not that the emotions are the only thing, but rather you're really trying to get this person to really feel good about what they're doing. You want them to really buy into it, is how we say it today. And these were the 3 kinds of appeals that a speaker in ancient times would make, and I think you see these 3 characteristics in Paul's speeches as well. There were 3 basic types of rhetoric, 3 types of purposes that any speech, any letter, anything like that would use in trying to approach a subject. Very often in New Testament speeches and sermons, you see a combination of these. But first of all, there was judicial or forensic. And by the way, this is on page 36 and 37, and if I can find it, I'll get there. Judicial or forensic rhetoric, the rhetoric of the law court. The rhetoric of attack and defense, the rhetoric of guilt and innocence. Periodically you see that in the New Testament. Deliberative. Now this is a large body of what you see in the New Testament. Deliberative rhetoric is you're trying to get somebody to weigh 2 choices and decide in favor of one as opposed to the other. You see that a lot in the New Testament. And then finally there is epideictic. Epideictic rhetoric is rhetoric in the public forum. It is like funeral eulogies. It is fond remembrances of people. It is the idea of lauding people for some noteworthy activity that they have done. You see that periodically in the New Testament as well. Typically, a speech And this is something that was kind of an eye-opener for me. I mean, when we analyze speeches, you know, you got the introduction, the body, and the conclusion. And, of course, they had that in ancient times, too. But they had a kind of a preferred way of doing it. And this is sort of how they described it. There's the exordium, which is the introduction. And I had noticed before that when I would read New Testament letters and read New Testament speeches, that how often is there sort of a historical prologue? There's just sort of a history of what's been going on lately. You see that a lot? That's called the narratio. That was good rhetorical form. You kind of look at the history or the setting or the facts of a case. Then usually, not always, but usually somewhere near the beginning of the speech, beginning of the letter, there is a proposition. There is a thesis statement. And that tells you a lot about what's going to follow. Then there's the probatio, which is the arguments and proofs. There is the refutatio. And you see this like in Galatians. You see it in a lot of contentious type letters and settings where there is a refutation of charges made by the opponent. And then there is the peroratio, which is the sort of summary and conclusion of all things. These are pretty typical elements. Take this list sometime and look through the speeches or sermons in the book of Acts. And you'll see it's a very enlightening approach. Also, epistles, letters, had a particular kind of structure to them. Again, there's the introduction, body, and conclusion. But Paul particularly would take each of these elements and very much, I say, Christianize them. He would put things in there that really just make them explode with statements of his faith. I'll let you read that. One thing I would point out, as this relates to what I just said about rhetoric, in Paul, in the body of the letter, is where you see his full-blown rhetorical skill. That's where he brings to bear all of his persuasive abilities. And I think that's how his letters differed a little bit from conventional letter writing in ancient times. This is a summary I found, I believe it was in Roland Allen's book, some things you commonly see in Paul's speeches and letters. There is an appeal to common ground. What do we believe in together? What are some things that you and I agree on? Then there is a statement of factual information. He typically then follows with offering proofs and answering objections. He always appeals to the spiritual needs of his audience, and he usually has some kind of warning about, look, if you reject this message, then here are the consequences that follow. This all speaks to Paul's ethos, his credibility as a speaker. He always had a sympathetic and conciliatory attitude toward his audience. He always openly acknowledged the difficulties and the disagreements between himself and his audience. He had respect for his hearers, and he had confidence in the truth of his message. I want to suggest that this is valuable to us at three different levels. Number one, it helps me appreciate Paul all the more. The man was a remarkable person. We know that already, and this just helps me appreciate it. But it also helps me understand, and I think it would help you understand as well, how do Paul's letters work? How does he make his case as he writes these letters? Why does he move from this section to this section? I think many times this can be answered in rhetorical terms. And finally, it sure lights a fire under me. What about my own persuasive abilities? How do I try to appeal to people when I teach the gospel? Do I use the full range of tools that are available? Do I use every type of legitimate form of persuasion? Or do I take the easy way out? Do I just try to take shortcuts in the method of persuasion that I use? It's a good lesson for me. I'm going to go ahead. Paul's character. Part 5, page 39 through 43. Athos is directly connected with the character of the speaker. And I think you see a lot of this particularly in 1 and 2 Thessalonians. Go over there for a minute. And largely in this section, a lot of what I did was just put some quotations directly from 1 and 2 Thessalonians. I came across a quotation by D. Bowman. And again, it's about the character of the speaker and why that is important. Preaching is not just the distribution of the message of the gospel. It's living the gospel at the same time. A good preacher emulates the message even as he delivers it. It's more than his passion. It's his model for living. The gospel's originator is his master, and he counts it a blessed privilege not only to distribute the teaching of his mentor, but to illustrate them in his life while he's doing it. Absolutely. The gospel has to be part of your life, not just a subject that you try to teach to others. You have to demonstrate it in your life if you want any credibility as a preacher. Another quotation, this time from Paul Earnhardt: "Passionate preaching does indeed derive from deep faith and conviction, but these demand a genuine effort to practice what one preaches. Character is more than mere conviction of righteousness. It is the determined effort to experience that righteousness in life. What we are attaches itself to what we preach. It either adds depth and force to the impact of God's Word on listeners, or it weakens and diminishes it." As I think about Paul as a preacher, I think of someone who was full of character, someone who was full of the life of Jesus, someone who embodied what every disciple ought to be. And I think that's one of the reasons why he was so enormously successful at what he did. You could not get past him. You saw him, you saw a genuineness about his faith, and you wanted part of that. I think that helps explain one of the reasons why Paul was so successful. As we looked at some of the... let's see here. Okay, yeah. Starting with point C on page 40, these are the observations that I have about his character. These are, again, statements from 1 and 2 Thessalonians. Number one, he put his character before these young converts as an example to follow. He says in chapter 1, verse 5 and 6, "You became imitators of us." In 1 Thessalonians 2, verse 9 and 10, "You recall, brethren, our labor and hardship, how working night and day so as not to be a burden to any of you, we proclaim to you the gospel of God. You are witnesses about how devoutly and uprightly and blamelessly we behave toward you believers." And several other statements are involved in that as well. He simply said, look, you have seen in me what I've been teaching to you, and you need to live up to that. Second, this is the top of page 41. He was very much concerned about their spiritual well-being. Look at the language in 1 Thessalonians 2. "We prove to be gentle among you as a nursing mother tenderly cares for her own children. Just as you know how we were exhorting and encouraging and imploring each one of you as a father would his own children, so that you would walk in a manner worthy of the God who calls you into his own kingdom and glory." I've always liked 1 Thessalonians 3, verse 1, "when we could endure it no longer." We just couldn't stand it, Paul says. We had to know how you were doing. I'm sure every one of us has had that kind of emotion towards someone that we've been working with. You are just consumed by their well-being. Point number three, he was willing to suffer for Christ's sake and for theirs. What a powerful method of persuasion to them. He says, look, I know you're suffering, but remember when we were there, we suffered as well. And Paul continued to suffer on their behalf as well. Paul was utterly transparent about his motives. Look at point number four at the bottom of page one. I'm quoting from 1 Thessalonians 2, verses 3 through 6. "Our exhortation does not come from error or impurity or by way of deceit, but just as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak not as pleasing men, but God who examines our hearts. For we never came with flattering speech, as you know, nor the pretext for greed. God is witness. Nor did we seek glory from men, either from you or from others, even though as apostles of Christ we might have asserted our authority." He said, look, you know why I was there. You saw that in me. I had nothing but the best motives. By the way, I think that was probably an answer that maybe some of the Jews in Thessalonica had accused Paul of being one of these wandering, itinerant philosophers. Hey, he showed up in town, he took your money, now where is he? And Paul assures them he has not forgotten about them. He is very much concerned about their spiritual well-being. Another example of his rhetoric, how he is trying to persuade them of the validity of his claims. Top of page 42, this is the fifth point. He commended to them and others their growth. He was not pessimistic about them. One of the things I find interesting, particularly in chapter 1 of 1 Thessalonians, and he mentions it elsewhere, is how he says, look, we have heard from others about you. How do you think that made these young converts feel? That already people were hearing about their faith. That is a powerful form of reinforcement. And that's exactly what Paul is trying to do as he writes this letter. Just reinforce, look, you guys are already on the right track. You are already doing what you need to be doing. I want you to know I've heard about that. That is a great thing. You just keep doing what you've been hearing. That is a wonderful method of reinforcement for them. One quotation from Robert F. Turner. What is preaching? It is the humbling dedication of self to the noble task of teaching the incomparable message of salvation in Jesus Christ. It is concern for the lost and brotherly love for the saved that puts their welfare above self. It is a lifetime of study and involvement and a determination to live as an example to others. It is all this and more, or it is a hypocritical sham, a commercializing of sacred things, a shameful disgrace. Perhaps this is why elderly preachers advise the young, don't preach if you can help it. Those who can't help it will be adequate for God's service and will wear themselves out in preparation for heaven. You have to be, in a sense, consumed by what you do as a gospel preacher. Last thing I want to talk about, just very briefly, is Paul's legacy. What kind of legacy does he leave behind? This is sort of my summary of everything I've been talking about. Number one, he left a legacy of preparation. He was biblically ready to teach the gospel. I believe he was academically ready to teach the gospel. And his whole life was preparation for the teaching of the gospel. We have to take every skill that we have. We have to take every experience that we have. We have to take everything that we have and put it in the service of what we do as ministers of the gospel. I think the most effective ministers of the gospel are those who have taken everything that they are, everything that they have, and used it in service of that. I quoted a moment ago from Robert F. Turner. I was privileged to meet him a few times before he died many years ago. And fortunately for me, it was about the time I started preaching. And boy, what a person to meet if you're just starting out preaching. But I greatly benefited from his letters. And one thing that always just amazed me about his letters, bulletins. When I would read them every month, I couldn't wait to get them. I'd open it up and just devour it. But one of the things I always got, how he used his life experiences in his articles. Always references to something he did back in 1930. References people that he had met, circumstances he had been in. Not just for good stories. They were great stories. But he used them in the service of his teaching. Paul used everything that he was, every advantage that he had, every bit of training, every bit of discipline in service of doing the work of the gospel. And that's what we need to do as preachers as well. Secondly, there was a legacy of purpose. And again, I look at how disciplined he was in his work. And boy, what an example for me. Every time I look at the Apostle Paul, I'm embarrassed. Every time I look at the Apostle Paul, I feel unworthy to even think about him. And yet, every time I study him, I feel encouraged. I feel like the fire has been lit yet again. Here is one more thing I can do to serve God by following his great example. And finally, there was a legacy of passion. Passion, first and foremost, for the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Passion for his fellow Jews, and passion for all mankind. And that is the kind of passion that we ought to have in our own work. By way of conclusion, wow, I got 2 minutes. Some of you have probably read F.F. Bruce's book, Paul, the Apostle of the Heart Set Free, great biography of the work of Paul. In the introduction, he said, no excuse is offered for the publication of yet another book on Paul, save the excuse offered by the second century author of the Acts of Paul. It was written amore Pauli, for the love of Paul. I've noticed, and probably you have too, that any time a group of preachers get together, somebody is going to say something about Paul. Why do we do that? It's because we recognize in him a great example. We recognize in him a kindred spirit. We recognize in him someone who is worthy of our imitation. And I hope that if you get nothing else out of this brief little paper, that you will get he is worthy of being imitated, not because he is our Lord, but because he was someone who faithfully followed the Lord, and he shows us so many things about how to go about this task of preaching the gospel. I believe I finished on time. That's all I have to say. Thank you.